Thank you. So, am I on here? Yeah. Okay, well, I want to thank Francis for the invitation and the organizing committee for this. It's been a really tremendous, I've been to, I think this is my fourth workshop and my last, too, which has really filled up my brain full of all kinds of things and new ways to go with, new directions to go with our models in approaching this. Now, this will kind of tie together yesterday from today, and I think one of the questions that arose of, you know, what do you have to know to be able to do this? And this is kind of the fusing together the mathematical side with the pharmaceutical side and maybe show you the knowledge base, or at least the types of people that would have to come together to do this in a practical way. And I mean practical by we're using today's tools, today's mathematical and computational tools, to be able to try to make an impact on the development of drugs. I'm here representing InSilico Biosciences, which is a company I worked for, or work for, and have been working for the last 5 years. I'm also affiliated with a couple of positions in Portland, at Portland State in System Science and Biomedical Engineering at OHSU. And the main theme of what I'm going to be talking about is taking mathematical models of microcircuits. These are models that we've talked about, particularly yesterday, of these types where we know the neurodynamics and receptor activations of parts of the brain. We can put it together into a model and then validate the model with clinical data to try to, as the theme has been today, of bridging the gap between the animal models and the preclinical models into the clinical data so that we can predict from what we know preclinically of how a drug might do once we get it into humans. Now, the methods and techniques and intuitions are coming actually, for my part, from computational neuroscience, and that's where I kind of developed into this field. But first, of course, my disclosure. I have that paycheck bias that I get paid by this company. These are the people involved. We're actually a very small company, three people, four including myself, and Hugo, who's the pharmaceutical side, and he actually was, as far as the Alzheimer's story, he was part of the team that developed galantamine, which is a very common drug use in Parkinson's, and also knows the industry from the inside out. Ethan was a basically an applied math degree from University of British Columbia and has been working with the company since then. Early days, like 99 is when the company started. And Robert Carr, who is not a biologist, not a mathematician, but is a businessman, and decided to develop a company. I think his terminology is to make more efficient use of intellectual capital. And so he kind of makes it into a company by putting us on a product program schedule and these sorts of things and making sure we stick to it. And so that we're not just three academics running around trying to understand the brain. And the business is to provide simulation support to pharmaceutical companies to help them predict how their drugs will do in human trials once they get there. So we work with quite a few companies. It's got a tangle here. I won't go into a lot of the names, but we worked with Pfizer, we worked with Roche, we worked with Johnson & Johnson, actually, was where they began. Hugo worked at Janssen in Belgium. And then through those connections had a long-term collaboration with Johnson & Johnson. And hope they listen to us. Of course, that's the trouble in this field, is because we can tell them their drug is good or bad, and we'll find out later. So, to give you a rundown of the talk, let's see. I started about 5 minutes ago. I want to see how much time I have. Try to keep track here. So I want to start off with some of the pharmaceutical industry, the problems, and Barry has covered some of this, and I think I want to go through steps because myself coming in from physics and then really computational neuroscience, I had no idea how bad it was. And so I think you should see this. It's pretty amazing. And then get into our model, and this is, you know, what Barry referred to as QSP, and I will call neuropharmacological modeling or computational neuropharmacology, as we'll eventually settle out the jargon, I think, in this whole field. It's probably going to be QSP, I think. It seems to be winning. It has the best white papers. Whoever funds it, I think is what it comes to. But anyway, we'll see. Show you how basically make a biophysical model, the level in which we're working at here, and so you can, you know, recognize that. How we introduce the pharmacology, and then the specific model I'll be talking about today, which is the working memory model. This will be the largest part of the talk, and then I'll show how we introduce pathologies into these models, schizophrenia, because we've done a lot, Alzheimer's, because that's the name of the session. And then what I call academic side effects that we get out of this. Because we're working for an industry, we have a focus for trying to look at a specific target, how that affects the brain, how that affects the patient. And in the same way that an engineer who's designing an airplane doesn't want to discover a new principle of aerodynamics, because that would kind of mess up the whole plane and he'd have to go back to the drawing board, we don't really want to discover anything. But occasionally we see things that might lend some knowledge about how a disease is progressing, why a certain compound works, and so we'll be looking at this here. So just kind of, there might be something that we can feed back to academia. And then if we have time, I'll mention some of the other projects we're working on. Yes? Yes, yes, I'll be fine with that, yeah. Yeah, no, there's nothing, you know, secret in this. let's see. Okay, so this is kind of old right now, but because you see the date here, it's 07. The blue lines show the cost, and this is this cost nightmare that we're facing. And the black line shows the new compounds out. This bump up here is because this graph adds biologics, a different class of drugs, and so you kind of have a bump up, but it continues to go down. And this is the problem, that the drugs are getting more expensive to generate, to create, and we're making fewer of them into the market, and this is, and so this is, of course, unsustainable, as many say. I want to go, why do these drugs fail? Well, these are the three phases of clinical trials, and of the first phase, coming into clinical trials, and this is first in humans to see, basically, if you have an effect, if the effect is going the right way, pretty much in normals, perhaps with some other drug that you know, pushes, that you're kind of creating an artificial deficit in which you want to see if your drug reverses or something like that. Already lose 60% when you first go into humans for various reasons. Then in the first phase two trials where you're trying to see efficacy and assess the doses, and it's really not assessing doses of, it's more like try your guess of what, of a couple of doses and see if it works. You lose a bunch more, so you're down to like only 20% left. And then when you finally get to through the very large phase three trials, you've lost 90% of the drugs that have gone into humans have failed. And it's an incredible failure rate. And for us as modelers, well, of course, this gives us a very low bar. Because really, to contribute, we only have to be 10% correct or better. Which is the opposite, of course, of computational neuroscience in academia, where you want to show that the mechanism you're discussing and stuff is correct within, you know, a P of 0.05, you know, 95% correct. And this is now a P of 0.9, is what we're striving for. So you would think that everyone would be doing this, but So Barry's gone over some of this as far as animal models, what's wrong with them. And I think this is just a series of different things, where there's differences in metabolism, there's difference in drug affinities. Actually, the drug affinities is a place where a computational model that's going from animal data to humans, we can put in the human affinities for receptors, so we can humanize the model in that way. And then, of course, we don't have the kind of functional genotypes, and when we put in the genes, then we don't actually get the phenotypes out of those genes in animals. Of course, different neural circuitry completely, particularly when you're talking about psychiatric and neurological diseases. As far as expressing that disease, it's going to be very difficult in anything but a human. And then there's placebo response also is becoming a bigger problem these days. And I'll even show you a little bit of how we kind of take a look at placebo response. Okay, so. No, there is none in mice. But in humans, there is actually quite a significant placebo effect. And, you know, this is how these drug trials, one of the places where they run into trouble, they show an effect, but it's not better than placebo, which is the gold standard, because the placebo effect would be so high. And there are several explanations as to why this might be, but still, it's a big enough problem. And it actually has grown. The placebo effect has grown in percentage. I don't know if you know the recent numbers from like 20 years ago in the U.S. trials have gone up to like 20% increase. So it makes a higher bar for the drug to go over. So these are reasons. Now, these are two early data points of in 91 and 2000. And the reason I wanted to show this was something else that Barry brought up, and I'd like to kind of get his feedback on this if what I'm thinking about this is true. But first, these are the reasons that trials failed in the 90s by 2000. But efficacy is very big, that the drug is not actually giving you as much of an effect as you want. There's safety considerations, toxicology. These are things we've run into. Commercial's gotten kind of big, and that's because companies are making crazier decisions as they get more desperate. But you see, the one thing has really dropped, which is PK, bioavailability, pharmacokinetic stuff that Barry had talked about. And I think that's when they actually start using this in modeling in the industry. So this is already a precursor into putting modeling into the symptomatic side of when they started modeling PK, those problems went down. And so this is probably a good example that we're going in the right direction. So how could computational neuropharmacology help this whole pipeline, where you start out with a whole bunch of possible compounds, narrow it down to one to get approval? Well, I think one thing is helping select in the beginning an optimal affinity and potency. And this is really, these two things are in drug discovery. Another thing is multiple receptor compounds. I mean, Barry had talked about, you know, it's a single target industry right now, and this has been the paradigm. Most of the good drugs, at least in schizophrenia for sure, are multi-targeted, and there's no way to do that without, I think, a computational model in which you can see how it's affecting the whole circuitry. What we mostly do is pre-screening compounds as they go into it. We would like to be here a little earlier. We mostly, you know, when you have a 90% failure rate, as a consultant, you know, you can pretty much just say it's not going to work very well and you're going to be, you know, right a lot. But with a model, we can explain why we think so. And then there are other things down further along. As far as experimental design, you can add in that of having virtual trials. You can predict the dose requirements and what kind of effect size you'll have, how sample you'll need. And you screen for side effects as well, and comparison with other marketed drugs as well, which is actually kind of the process of doing it. Now, also, there was a company called Intellos that was doing some of this modeling as well, and they were pushing for adding that to part of the screening process in FDA, and they were lobbying for that. I left this on here. I had this from before when they were actually still a company. Last summer, they went bankrupt, which shows that there's kind of a difficulty of penetration, and so they kind of grew too fast. We're still down to four people, so we don't have that kind of overhead, but then just basically ran out of money before they got enough contracts to keep themselves alive. Okay, so now I'll go into the modeling, and now we'll actually touch on some mathematics. Well, first of all, and this is always the challenge with computational neuroscience, is that we want to make a model that's tractable, but because we're looking for how pharmaceuticals affect the brain, we don't want it to be too simple either. So we don't want a homer brain. We want something that's, you know, complex enough to capture the effects of the whole network. Now, the goal is to bridge the gap between this preclinical data and the clinical trials. So here's our scale from simplicity, because I didn't want to insult anyone. I put in one of my old models, which is basically just a noisy box. You have inputs, and you get spike probability out. And you can use that to do nice analytic solutions of, in this case, it was a spike timing dependent learning rule and how it would work, you know, to give you some output and understand the full dynamics of that. On the other side, it's like the Blue Brain Project, where you try to do as accurate model as you can. And I've heard, actually, Henry, there was another comment that Henry Markham the other day, but I actually heard him at some talk when he was presenting it saying, we could never do this kind of work that I'm talking about today until we have the big brain, the big model of the whole brain, his billion-euro brain, which will be 10 years down the line. And so what I want to get to is say, well, I think we have enough stuff now to go down to a simpler scale, but still have enough of the dynamics that we both understand the dynamics in the model but can connect it to function. And so we want to be simple enough to understand the dynamics, which is more in my comfort zone, but detailed enough to include the pharmacology. Now, I put in this example because this is one of my favorite little models, because the objective, this is Pinsky and Renzel, and the objective was to get a model that was complex enough but simple enough so that it had clear dynamics, but it was complex enough to behave like a pyramidal cell. And so what we do is we start with a peer-reviewed model, kind of gives us a little credibility, and also when we're jumping into a part of the brain that we don't understand very well. I mean, for me, I was in did studies in brain stem of fish and bats and things. So to jump into these parts of the brain that I was kind of afraid of because they were uncontrolled, like the cortex and the basal ganglia, use other models in a sense. So this is input from the computational neuroscience community into this. And then add necessary currents and receptors as necessary. Now, because these are well-studied models, the dynamics of them are very well understood. So it's a good starting point when we're going to start adding other things on and then see how it gets more complicated or to see it as kind of a perturbation around something that we already understand. And we also have to add things depending upon the target or request of a client in the sense that they have a certain target that's not in our model, and we have to put that in. So we put in a new receptor that couples to some current that we don't have, and then we have to put that into just to be able to get the right pharmacology in the model and any other missing dynamics that we may need to look at. On the other side is we initialize the parameters of the model and the behavior of the model from, you know, literally hundreds of articles. And a lot of those go into the creation of these original models that we use. And so this is actually, I mean, what's great about this, it's a way in which, and it will be used, it may not be by us, but because it is such a good way to collect all of those articles over the years, where one guy worked on a receptor, someone else worked on something over here, someone else worked on something over here, all collecting dust or whatever the equivalent of PDF dust is, and pull them together into a model in which you can make conclusions from. So, and then in the end, calibrate the model with human data, clinical data. And these would be things from clinical trials in which some drugs have been run. We understand the drugs, the pharmacology, how it affects the model, and then have some output of the model that we calibrate with this clinical data. And I'll show you how we do that. Now, for my part, I really like this part over here. This is my background. I understand it. Hugo, he comes from the pharmaceutical industry. He likes this part over here. You know, so these are different sides at it. I mean, he understands the industry. He's been in it a long time. I get tired of these because I see, you know, insight into how the biology works from reading clinical data. But for him, he knows all the players, so it's, you know, I feel like I'm just in the middle of a soap opera and I don't know who's who. Yes?
What kind of
Excuse me?
What kind of
These would be like large trials, you know, certainly like large trials, phase two, phase three trials, where that after a drug is approved, then it's published, and then it will show how some clinical scale changes because of a drug compared to, say, a placebo. And so you'll have, all right, say, well, why don't I move on? I'll get there. This will be clear. All right, we'll go through this quickly because most of the mathematicians here know how these models are put together. We're using a Hodgkin-Husby framework, so we all start with basically think of neurons as complicated capacitors who have currents that can pass through. So we have a current equation for a change in membrane potential. And these currents are based upon really multi-state mathematics. And so this goes into our Hodgkin-Huxley equations, which have different currents that change the voltage. Over here, well, I can't even point it. Over there is the voltage, and they generate spikes and also other kinds of sub-threshold behavior and the kinds of dynamics that we've been talking about for several days. And are, I think, really necessary to understand these dynamics in developing these models. All right, now we have to connect these together with synapses. And as you know, synaptic release and current generation is a complicated process with multiple steps. We will simplify it down into whatever our presynaptic spike was that was generated from our Hodgkin-Huxley model. And the output is some current generated. And all of this complicated dynamics will be put into basically one variable, which contains both the presynaptic release probability and the postsynaptic receptor conductance. Now, there's more than just these ionotropic receptors. There's also metabotropic receptors. And this is where we start getting into the pharmacology and adding in the effects that are not just an ion current going into the cell, but affects the ionic currents, either synaptic or membrane currents, through a secondary process that's opening some other channel. And there are lots of these, and many of them are used in regulatory, are involved with pharmaceuticals. You know, since the company has a history with schizophrenia, we have a lot that are associated with schizophrenia that we need to put into the model, like dopamine and serotonin. Yesterday talked about muscarinic receptors as well. And so we really needed to, and so, you know, this is, we have to put these parts together. So how do we put them in? You can see this is complex diagram where you have some neurotransmitter synapse, and you've got, you know, which picks it up and goes through secondary mechanisms and kinase activations and changes effectors in here. Here's a nice complicated map. And there are also pathologies at different receptors along the way. Instead of doing all this internal modeling, we take this, I think, pretty, I didn't think this up, so I can say I think this is a pretty smart idea of doing just a simple linear relationship between the activation and the change of, say, some current, some maximum conductance. And the reason I think it's smart is because you don't have to deal with all of this stuff, which is good, that you can think of these as if they are modulators and not drivers of the system, as a perturbation in whatever dynamics you already have. And so you're shifting it, say, within a linear approximation of where it was. Now you run into trouble, and we've run into trouble, when you have something, you have an extremely strong agonist, say, for something that's usually not activated that strong, and then you get way off of that small perturbation, and you get down into, you know, where you can't trust your model. So as long as you're not pushing it around too much, you can trust this kind of linear approximation. Occasionally we have to modify it, but it usually works pretty well. And then there's a parameter that couples how much change you get for an activation. And that parameter we first get from the in vitro literature is usually where it comes from. And then that is what we tune when we start comparing our models with clinical data. Okay, so to get started, how do we get those activations? To get the activations, we have a model of a synapse, where we have a competition model in which you have some kind of some concentration of your neurotransmitter, or here dopamine as a modulator, and where you can activate, but you also, that competes with, say, a couple of agents. Maybe you have a drug, maybe you have a tracer, maybe they're in at the same time, and you want to be able to, and maybe you've got a metabolite as well, because some of these drugs then, you know, create metabolites which may be active at the same site, and so you have to have a drug metabolite neurotransmitter interaction. So we need to have that kind of complexity in there. So we also have presynaptic receptors that you have to consider, and there are other issues, like you have enzymes that may be taking out, you have transporters that may be in there. All of this is sort of put in basically with a series of differential equations on concentration. And so we're not tracking individual molecules, we're really just looking at the concentrations and how they vary and compete. Okay, so the whole scheme now is, and this is kind of the framework in which we work in, where we use the competition model to come up with receptor activations. Then we use those receptor activations to affect different currents in our network model, that we then run our network model and get out maybe spike trains. This would be, say, a 30 neurons representing prefrontal cortex, where you have 20 pyramidal cells and 10 inhibitory interneurons. And what you get out is some inhibitory interneurons firing at different sets of pyramidal cells, some on and some off, giving you bursts. You take that, and that could be a function. In this case, it represents working memory, and this is what we'll go into next. So you have a working memory span that you correlate with some kind of clinical data. In this case, it would be in-back tests, where people basically are required to remember something that had happened a few steps ago. And this is a good test because it fails for schizophrenics have a high failure rate, and so some of their cognitive deficits may be coming from working memory. So it may be a kind of measure of cognitive ability. And so then we use that to get some kind of, and then we can use our model for a novel drug, since we have our receptors tuned, to predict what a novel drug might do on this scale. So let's look at this working memory model. This is the example I'll use. Now, this comes from Dershowitz, and it's basically a recurrent network of excitatory pyramidal cells and an inhibitory interneuron, only one type. So this is simpler. This is much simpler than some of these hippocampus models we've seen, where we have multiple inhibitory cell types. And sort of we add them when needed. At this point, in this model, we don't. It has simple two-state dynamics, and so one could model it as a two-state system. And this is these graphs are made from this. And this is how I always think about it, because I'm still back in physics math land, where I want to think of it as a simple example. And then, although I have all this complexity around it, that's just kind of modulating that simple example in my head. And when I'm wrong, then I try to figure out what's wrong. But you started at in this case, say you start in an upstate, it bounces around because there's noise in the system until it pops out of the upstate into the downstate. Here is on a phase plane of these two variables. I don't know if you can see. Yeah, those are little tiny arrows. You probably can't see them. But they point to two attraction basins. One in the upstate, where I start up here in an upstate, falls into this attractor and bounces around there for a while until it pops out and then drops to the bottom state. And so the working memory task is you give it a stimulation, pops into the upstate, and see how long it lasts up there until it drops down. And so that will depend upon the excitability of these cells, of both the excitation and the inhibition, and the balance between the excitation and the inhibition. So a drug that gives more, well, say you have a pathology where you have more inhibition, less excitation, then you'll have shorter working memory. And a drug may try to reverse that or may make it worse. All right, so we'll now run through the steps of going from receptor competition model. We have this cleft where we have, say, for this example, serotonin in the cleft, a metabolite of some drug, and the parent molecule, which was the drug, its metabolite, and then the natural neurotransmitter. Presynaptically, there's receptors that inhibit release. And postsynaptically, there's several receptors, each of which has its own affinity to all of these different compounds. Now, the drug and the metabolite may affect a subset of these. And so we put these receptor activations that we get into a compartmental model. And this model, the pyramidal cells have four compartments, and the inhibitory interneurons have two. And these are just the serotonin. And to show you how our couplings are, just to give you an example, I actually put this in just last night, because I figured, I think there's a piece that needs to go in. Say you have some serotonin. What is that? This is serotonin 2A, which affects a couple of channels here, a sodium and a potassium channel, and serotonin 4, which inhibits a couple of potassium channels. And so 2A would, both of these would excite the cell. And then you have also effects on the synapses. And here you have another serotonin 3 that affects a synaptic current. Now, these couplings that we always find are incomplete. We do it and we do it again and do it again and find new literature, sometimes find new old literature that we hadn't seen before. So this is something that's always expanding. And I think all of these models, I go back to we only have, if we're 60% correct half the time, then we're three times better than the industry. And so, we keep adding and adjusting and trying to improve, the pharmacology and the biology of our models at the same time that, we're trying to improve basically our correlation with clinical data. And because of we're talking about Alzheimer's and the cholinergic system is important there, I wanted to show that we have some kind of, these get a little bit complicated in how we have these. So where the muscarinic, the M1 receptor is, direct to affecting channels, but we also have an M2 autoreceptor on the cholinergic release. So that adjusts cholinergic release. And then we also have then alpha-7 receptor on presynaptic terminals that affects glutamatergic release. So you have quite a complicated system that is all affecting basically your synaptic currents. And here's another case where you have effects of alpha-4, beta-2 cholinergic receptors that are affecting release of GABA in these types of cells. So we have these four compartments, and we have receptors for all of them, these carrying our pharmacology. and we put these into cells, all our compartments into two types of cells. We connect them up synaptically, and the synapses carry also this pharmacology. And we have recurrent network between the pyramidal cells, and there's actually a recurrent network with the inhibitory neurons as well, and then they're coupled together. And then we have a background noise in the system too. Now this, the basics of this model is actually downloaded from ModelDB, and then we added all the other stuff on it. But it was the original Dershowitz model. I'm about to, after the schizophrenia session, I'm probably going to make some major changes to our present model, which has been one of the things that's great about these workshops. So then this is all coupled into a large network. The original Dershowitz model had 30 neurons. We've expanded that to 100, and the reason is that when dealing with Alzheimer's disease, we found we needed a resolution of when we start plucking cells out and eliminating synapses. 30 neurons did not give us the resolution to make the small changes that would give you the pathology. It would just go abruptly from, you know, prodromal to advanced by pulling one or two neurons out. And so we wanted to get some stages through. So we expanded the model. And this was the smallest workable model that we could use. So to demonstrate, you know, the spike trains you get out of this model, there's the green lines are the excited or the stimulated set of pyramidal cells. There's two of them shown, and you can see a little bit of blue in there, which is the unexcited ones, and the orange are the two inhibitory interneurons. And you basically have a spiking neural network model, which is giving an output when you give it a burst. Well, you give it a stimulus that would be like a cue to hold a thought, and it goes along until it finally jumps out from the upwell to the downwell, and you lose that thought. And this, so this is a measure of working memory. It's a stochastic model, so we have to run sets. It's actually rather, I like stochastic models, and so therefore we make it so, and then we run sets so we get a distribution of how long that working memory is. Now this is, in comparing to, say, the clinical situation, this would be within a single patient. So it would be like a single patient doing the same trial, and we do it 40 times because that's a manageable size for this size of model. And each trial they may do a little better or a little worse. Now if we were to do virtual trials, then we would use different models with different parameter settings, each of which would do these trials. And then we could get a broader distribution. So we'll have error bars. Do I show them next? Well, I'll get to it. This is a measure, how we measure a working memory span. We have activity. These points are spikes of, in this case, 30 cells. This is a smaller network. And this gives us an instantaneous rate until it drops below a certain level where we call the working memory span. And that gives us our output. Now we'll look at how to put pathology into the model. Now then I'll show you examples of different working memory spans. Now, why do we do schizophrenia? Well, one thing, that was where we started as a company, or they started before I joined. And and so they're working with schizophrenia drugs. And also, because schizophrenia drugs hit so many receptors, it's a very good set of drugs to tune a whole range of receptors with. And so then when we come with novel drugs that hit subsets of those, we actually already have a pretty well-tuned model. For instance, D1 activation is in the cortex is a hypodopaminergic state. So there's too little dopamine. So we bring that down for a pathology. There's an NMDA dysfunction. So we bring that down a little bit. There are changes in GABA conductances. And actually, David Lewis gave a talk at the schizophrenia workshop. And then we have background noise. There seems some evidence that there's a larger background noise, but this is from EEG data. But it does actually seem to play a role as far as in helping us tune our models. Now, here are a whole bunch of drugs along the bottom here at different doses for different subgenotypes. And so what we had done was we collected data on the effect of different drugs on working memory and the effect of comp polymorphisms on working memory. And then we put those into our model. The comp gene affects an enzyme that takes dopamine out of the cleft. And so we basically change the time constants of how long dopamine is in that cleft, and that which gives us another parameter to tune. And then each of these drugs, with these cartoons at the bottom here, show all the different receptors that these drugs hit. And so, for instance, clozapine is very complex. You have all kinds of serotonin and cholinergic and dopaminergic receptors that it will block at different varying degrees. And we have all these affinities and potencies. And here's olanzapine, which has fewer. And so each one of these models has used the competition model with this drug in order to get a working memory span as the output. And these error bars are for that one set of, say, 40 working memory span trials. And then these are weaved together. And I say weaved together because the actual literature that we collect this from will have not always very specific drugs. We'll sometimes say atypical antipsychotics were used in this part, in this arm of the trial, and then a certain drug in another. And so we have to kind of reverse engineer what they mean by that. This is the most tedious part of the is pouring through the literature, trying to find a point that you can use, and then how to implement that point. But this is the INBEC, where you're given basically a series of letters, sounds, figures, and then you have to remember where you were. Either one step back, that would be one step back. Two steps back, that would be two. Three. Schizophrenia tends to collapse at two. And those 17 simulations were combined into these 9 data points as far as how those different populations, and we combine different, and then we make a fit between what their working memory span was or what the clinical INBEC results were and what the working memory span. So do you think that answers the question of what kind of data we're looking for is clinical data? Yes, behavior data, yeah. And there's a, depending upon the model, because we have like an EEG model, and then we're actually measuring with EEG, the problem with that, which, you know, people like that because then it could be a biomarker, a good metric that they could actually use to measure if their drugs hit the target. For us, it tends to be very sparse because people are not using EEGs as a diagnostic in trial, so there isn't a lot of data on it. A lot of people are using it to see, can you use it as a diagnostic? So you might have control in schizophrenia, and then maybe some, and then you have to figure out if that schizophrenic had drugs, what kind of drugs they had. And some trials they don't, or some papers they don't tell you, so you have to throw that paper out. You know. But so they're sparse. Now on the other end of the scale is a standard scale for schizophrenia is called the PANSS scale. It's used in all major drug trials. So you have every drug that's been on the market, PANSS scores on different concentrations, doses of these drugs. And so we can use that, but the scale itself is very dirty in the sense that it's a clinician who's asking questions to a patient. And so it can go all over the place. And so there you have lots of dirty data, some cleaner, sparse data, and trying to put these sort of things together. And this is something that, as far as Barry had mentioned, as far as there are vaults, I'm sure, in pharmaceutical companies of data that we would love to have. And that if they could get over their IP issues about different kinds of compounds, how they did in different patient groups, we would be able to use all that and incorporate it into a model like this. And so it's one of these things that on a political level, on an economic level of trying to get some kind of consortium or something to get the industry more cooperative with each other would really help this kind of modeling and push it forward. Okay, so now to implement Alzheimer's disease, well, one of the hallmarks is pulling things out, basically die-off of different percentages of pyramidal cells and synapses. Now, we've talked about over the last 2 days the progression from entorhinal cortex through hippocampus and into other parts of the brain, prefrontal cortex. This right now is kind of a generic cortical model where there's a deficit happening. And so it's a little bit difficult to say, you know, we call it prefrontal cortex because that's where the working memory task is supposedly going on. But, you know, some of this pathology is happening really in other places, and this is something that I need to reconsider and try to figure out how to make sense of this. But basically, we apply the pathology in this kind of way, pulling pieces out. We also have, there's a cholinergic deficit that's known in Alzheimer's disease. And so we take down the cholinergic tone of our receptors. And so to calibrate with Alzheimer's disease, there's an ADAS COG scale, which is a cognitive scale for Alzheimer's. Working memory is a piece of that. The data is published on this scale, and so we use that and we use working memory as sort of a surrogate for that scale and try to do that comparison. This is for different drugs and different receptors, mostly dealing with cholinergic system, and also actually there was a serotonin 6 in here as well. Now we could get, or we would, you know, correlate, tune our model to these data, and here's all the data pooled together of for all these different data points on the previous page, and implementing those in our model, we get this comparison and basically minimize our square, or maximize our R squared, our correlation. Also, at different stages of the disease, so a big part of this correlation comes from that we can actually tune the model for as far as cognitive deficits by pulling out synapses, and you know you can get a lot there, but there's different drugs within each that we're also tuning in these. So even we're happy that even on a week-by-week basis, or at least at different stages of the disease, we also have a match to the pharmacology, and it's not just a matter of pulling out synapses as time goes on. Okay, so now we'll get into the academic side effects, and I think these are things that maybe we can bring back to the community and say, you know, is this valuable as well, if it can come out of this? Because it's not really the intent to find out anything, but it might have something to say. One thing is that these parameters that we're tuning actually do have a physiological meaning. And we're still kind of fiddling around with that. I mean, for my part, you know, coming from a physics background and thinking that it's just a little parameter, you know, we just use it as a lever in our model and, you know, to perturb away for pharmacology, but they actually mean things. You know, for instance, there's a slope of how fast we're taking synapses out, and does this match data? Well, so this simulation can actually kind of back up what kind of losses per week have been found. And so we have, and this is very difficult stuff to obtain. You know, you have to take, you know, brains from people at different stages. And here's also a loss of synapses. And we seem to be at least within these bounds, which less as a scorecard for our model, I would rather see it as being supportive of these data that are already out there, because there isn't a lot of data. Some of these there are, as far as the cholinergic deficit, we're at the low end of, low middle end of that range. And as we go on down here, so these may be actually saying something about the progression of the disease, where the models actually make a prediction about the disease and not just already now to make a prediction about a new compound. For instance, in the case of after a certain fraction of loss, there's a sudden change in how sensitive the model is to pulling out synapses. And this comes at about the time where there seems to be a more precipitous loss of cognitive function. And so we find in the dynamics of the model that loss. This is really more of a validation where after we attune the model, we then put in a type of genotype in the sense of implemented this genotype with extrasynaptic loss and cholinergic tone decrease to see what kind of losses we have. And then we have the biggest negative effects of the genotype are actually in the early stages, but in later stages it kind of comes out to be about the same. So it seems to flatten out here. Actually two alleles, it actually flattens out later on as far as the deficit becomes stable, and you get the most loss in the early stages of the disease. Oops, didn't go that far. Now, we talked about memantine yesterday, And I think this will now be the third theory of why memantine works in late stages, because we had, first of all, that memantine stops or slows. Well, so memantine is a weak NMDA inhibitor. And so I guess you mentioned the sort of the general thinking about it was, what was it? Well, the general thinking about it, I'm trying to think this through now, because I just heard that yesterday. Well, all right, I'll say the other one. That was inhibiting synaptic plasticity, and so that runaway plasticity was being stopped, and so it was stopping the disease there. What we actually have is that because you're pulling out cells and you're pulling out synapses, part of the loss of working memory is a shifting from an excitatory system to an inhibitory system, where the inhibitory cells are taking over, and you have more excitatory synapses onto the inhibitory neurons. And so what memantine does is reduces that inhibitory tone after you get down for a while. So in the MCI, you give someone memantine, you know, very early stage, and in humans, and it acts like ketamine, you know, reducing working memory and reducing the function. But later on, as you've lost function, it actually picks up significantly, where you get a little bit of increase of function, and we think that's reducing the inhibitory tone in the system. Okay, so how much time on? All right. I could stop now. Okay, I'll just run through these real quick. Because we'll have no detail. And also, we're just going to move into discussion. So I actually have all afternoon. Other projects, we have a striatal model that's been used for schizophrenia. It's basically a median spiny neuron with different inputs and different pharmacology. We're in the process of expanding this, particularly after the Parkinson's workshop and as well as the schizophrenia workshop. You know, there's dynamics in the striatum that I would like to include. We have an EEG model which generates rhythms, and this is probably the closest connection I have with the hippocampal people here is because it's the same kind of circuitry. And now we have more than one subtype. We have actually two subtypes of inhibitory interneurons, and I actually had to include a thalamus to get some of the symptoms, and get different frequencies, and then you know have this also calibrated. One that we're working on now, and which I really enjoyed the Parkinson's workshop for this model, is we're still in the developmental stage, so this isn't tuned at all. But this is the kind of thing that 5 years ago I would have thought was crazy, you know, to make a basal ganglia circuit connected with a thalamus and a piece of cortex and think that you're going to get something more than gobbledygook out of it. And my thinking was like, how could you possibly? But now I can see that, okay, if we develop these pieces, each of which we know the dynamics, and we couple these sort of chunks together and then the pharmacology as a perturbation, we can actually use this to learn something about how the system works, but more importantly, how a drug will affect some readout from the model that we can use to predict how novel drugs will work. And so this really just has, you know, we can have the two states. It's kind of a high frequency. It's still beta for a Parkinson's state and gamma for a normal state. And also we were kind of pitching to Huntington's Foundation, and so we took out the striatum and made some thalamic, you know, so you actually can have a thalamic output that looks kind of like Huntington's case. Anyway, and then, of course, where we eventually would love to be is back at the beginning of the development pipeline of coming up with new multi-targeted drugs. So now that we have a model that's correlated and we know what the clinical outcome is, we can then use the model backwards to find out what would be the optimal receptor activations in order to get a high clinical output. So sort of now optimizing the activations, rather than starting with the activations and seeing what the output is, try to optimize the activations to give us our best clinical outcome and take out some side effects that we can also use the model to predict. And then use that to design a new drug that could be multi-targeted. And then run it through the model to make sure it works and do some iterative checking to make sure, and then you have a new compound. And I think in this way you can do a couple of things you can that you can't really do now. One is you could find compounds that are multi-targeted, which are very difficult now. You could also put different genotype variations to make actual, think of what kind of compounds or combinations of compounds would affect specific and start getting to kind of more personalized medicine. And then I'll just put this slide back up again as to what kind of the pipeline is and open up for questions. Thank you. So, that was a lot fast, huh? I see a tired look. Yes. Yes, yes.
And I guess my understanding of the kind of potential mechanism is that players having more flexibility on interneurons is because interneurons are considered more polarized potential. And so maybe you can kind of pop off and the relative effect of NMDA receptor 1 interneurons is kind of amplified.
Yeah, right, right.
That's
basically it. Yeah, that's basically it. So because you've lost excitatory excitation in the system, basically, they're pulling out excitatory neurons, then the inhibition has taken over more, and so you lose the memory function, and the memetine will bring down their excitability again. So that's really what we're thinking. Yes. Yeah, part of it is correlation. I mean, sometimes we can really see that we don't have a necessary current. I'm trying to think of a good example. All right, so I think this is one I was working on the other day. All right, so we had pharmacology in the model, and there was a couple of drugs that were just way off. And we saw these drugs hit 5-HT4, and then that required putting in some other currents. But if you could see that some drugs were way off, then you look at what their affinities are, and then you see, okay, that's missing from our model. Okay, so to put in that pharmacology, to put in that receptor, we might have to couple that to another current in the model. So it's kind of try to start small and simple and build up from there. It's really the idea. And starting point is kind of, like I said, from the literature in the middle, you know, where we're not looking at the kind of marker models, but you know, I always want a model in which I can understand the dynamics, you know, already, and it's not already too complex for me. And so, you know, we're getting to like your models, which are at my upper limit. I mean, they're kind of beyond my comfort zone as far as you have a lot of compartments, and so I would like, but you probably understand those models. So if you put pharmacology in that model, you probably understand the dynamics to actually work with it. So I think it depends maybe on the individual and how well they understand the model as well to work with it. Yes. Yeah. Unfortunately, not right now. I wish I could put up at the end and looking for 25 people. Yes and no. You can think of us as four guys in a garage soldering together components. So we will rent space on the Amazon cloud if we want to, and so it winds up being like sort of for some of these models like 20 cents an hour for maybe 8 processors, and you know, so we could do then 15 sets, you know, rent 15 computers for a week, you know, several times. Mostly we just run it on Macs, you know, Macs and PCs with, you know, 8 processors and can do this kind of stuff. And that's another thing about the complexity is, you know, if it's getting so complex I can't run it on my Mac, then I can't reiteratively tune the model myself to understand it. And so that's kind of my, and that's more of a conceptual, you know, limitation that I have. But it's not, you know, it's not at the level of supercomputers right now. I think the industry will evolve to that if this stuff is implemented. But it gets, I think once you start losing touch with the dynamics, then it starts just becoming, you know, these just broad searches. You know, part of it is, you know, for us, since it is hands-on, we can actually find, okay, this drug is off for this reason, and we can change the model to improve it. You know, when you start getting, you know, hugely complex models with lots of parameters that you're tuning, and then you can't see what's affecting what, you know, to try to improve the model and actually make your correlations better. But we'll see. I think there's, once more people get in the industry, there'll be different prejudices, and you'll probably get some really clever, you know, computer scientists that can actually come out with other results. But it's a difference between a big data approach, you know, where you know, you're really data mining. I mean, in a sense, you know, it's trying to collect together a lot of information, but every piece is kind of labor intensive to put in right now, anyway. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And on the third step, you said that you essentially do a literature review, trying to find parameter values and ranges of values that you can constrain your model.
Yeah.
Now those parameter values, they tend to come from in vitro,
right.
Animal,
right.
Yeah.
Okay, so two things happen here. So one is, we'll then use human receptor affinities. So we'll switch that. What we can do to humanize the model, we'll do ahead of time. And then the second thing is, understand that, you know, a clean little piece of, you know, mouse brain in a dish is not going to have all the receptors that the human brain is going to have. And so those parameters will then drift, and we let them drift. Yeah, you know, so when we do the coupling between the receptors and whatever it effect is on a channel, we would start, all right, so they get, when they flood the bath with dopamine, they get a change of this current by 25%. And all right, we'll start there, but more often than not, it goes out of that range. You know, it goes far away from there. And sometimes even reverses. We have like one parameter that's negative now. And because I usually think if it goes up one. And so I'm uncomfortable in putting too much physiological meaning to those, although other people do. And so I think because you are putting together pieces that are, you know, the thing that's right is we know that you know, this receptor affects that current. But how it adjusts it in combination with whatever else is going on in the brain is then, I think, a lot more touchy and a lot more difficult to interpret in a complicated model. That gets beyond my level of comfort with the complexity. And so then I want to just think of the parameters as just parameters. Now, we've had clients say, you know, I want to know the range of variability of your parameters, so because that's our effect. You know, we have this target that does this effect, and we want to know how big that is. You know, how big a range can we be confident about? And I mean, yeah, I'll do the calculation, but I'll kind of go, you know, I'm a little uncomfortable about what it means. Yeah, semi-automated, you know, we would do some runs. We basically, we take however many, or a set of parameters, we take that many directions in the parameter space and do, you know, checking on each side and shift it and do some checking and shift it. It's, you know, another case, we do have some like hill climbing and some of these parameters and run it for a while. That tends to run a really long time, and it's very much more difficult to make a hill climber that stochastic. That I think that's more time consuming. You know, we'll do kind of a grid search, and you know, the optimization could probably be better than what we get, but you know, we want to get it good enough so that we have a pretty confident feel for the model, and particularly in the range of, you know, where these, what kind of new drugs are going to be put in there, and how far they're going to push it around. Yeah. Yeah, it's, and that depends upon who we're working with. So it's usually, you know, I mean, Hugo and Robert will, you know, do the marketing as far as giving pitches to companies, you know, try to get into someone who's model friendly, which is usually through PK departments, actually, or can often be that. Sometimes there are people further up. You hit at different ends of it. But anyway, and so whatever compound they're working on, it's usually, I mean, you know, it's kind of, in practice, I think it's we're going to start trials with this drug. Can you help us feel better about it? I think that's the answer they want. And so, you know, they contract outside because they have their own, you know, institutional issues about everyone, you know, trying to be nice and not say that their bosses are wrong about their target or something. And, you know, which is a bias, I think. And so take this outside group, they'll come in and then evaluate the drug, you know. And so that's usually why that happens. And also whatever, as far as the pharmacology that we get from the literature, then it depends on what drugs have basically have been out there and we have data from. Yeah. Oh.
Okay.
One more?
Okay. Sorry.
And then we'll move into the discussion. Yeah, we'll bring. They're going to bring in lunch and we'll just have a discussion.
All right. If I'm sitting in a company and I'm triaging your proposal, let's say I've got a 5-HT6 antagonist. Can you put it into your model and tell me what features I'm going to need? What potency, what half-life do I need? And then the next question is, you've got these models that are all neurons.
Mm-hmm.
But the brain's 90% glia.
Yeah, right, right.
And it's a shift.
Yeah, yeah. That shifty landscape with the glia, we don't include in the model, and we don't have, the only way that we include that would be with transporters, and that would affect the half-life of the drug, basically, in the cleft.
So do you come up with a target product profile?
Yes.